This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
I'm Wong Xiaoning, and this is the Breakfast Grill. Now, we have all heard of children of rich families trying to build a franchise of their own. Some succeed, while others, of course, fail. So today, we speak to Raja Hamza Abidin Raja Nong, managing partner of RHL Ventures, a private equity fund that was formed by four millennials who come from diverse backgrounds but share one thing in common: significant family wealth, who are, though, trying to make a name for themselves in capital markets. Now, welcome to the show, Raja Hamza. I mean, you're not a newbie on the Breakfast Grill. You were here last in November 2017. But I see some changes to the partners. Like, it was formed with four of you, right? So there's Rachel Lau, daughter of the late Lau Boon An, Jojo Kong, the daughter of the Nirvana Asia founder, Tan Sri Kong. Yourself, you are, of course, the son of well-known politician and former FT minister, Dato' Sri Raja Nong Chik. But I noticed Lionel Leong, the son of Tan Sri Leong Hoi Kam, of Ma Sing fame, is not on that list anymore of partners. What happened there? Because he was the L in the RHL, right?
Yes. So just on a brief background, we've built up our team since then. So we've gotten actually another two partners on board, Chen Shun, who's based in Singapore, and also Nudin, who's a PhD graduate who's based out of Australia, to help us with the tech due diligence. In terms of Lionel, he's just taking a step back to just focus on his family business for the moment, but we still consult him from time to time on the investments and some of the corporate partnerships that we do for the companies we invest in. For instance, if there's a property deal, obviously we will talk to him about it.
But is his family money still involved in RHL Ventures then?
He's still involved, but he's more as a, now more from a corporate development partnership perspective.
So this leads to the next question, you know, because how committed is everyone to RHL Ventures, especially for the three of y'all right now? I mean, it's not a hobby, is it? Because let's be honest for y'all, your family businesses are so much larger than RHL Ventures, right?
That's definitely true, but the way I see it, in a decade or a bit more than that, we want this business to be bigger than our family businesses. We want to build this into a diversified Southeast Asian financial platform, right? If you look at around the region, our funds are still investing in the likes of KKR, CVC. Why not invest in a local brand? We are trying to build that. There isn't a strong local investment brand. We've seen some, obviously, PE guys prop up. We've seen some advisory firms pop up. But there's no one that does across different asset classes, whether it's property, VC, PE, advisory. The potential to build a financial platform in Southeast Asia is huge. If you look at in terms of just technology investments, for instance, we saw about, in 2018, about $10 billion that flooded the market. That's about double of what you saw the year before. And this year, I would say it'll be another record year. So in terms of capital, in terms of interest, I only see that increasing. And as a firm who's based in Malaysia and focuses on Southeast Asia, it depends how aggressive we want to be in terms of taking advantage of those opportunities. I think, generally speaking, Malaysians are a bit more risk-averse in terms of taking new risk, given that we've been in a bubble where we've always been supported by Petronas and the oil profits. But if you look at Southeast Asia as a whole, GDP is growing 6%+. I just came back from Vietnam and there was a demo day to look at startups, and there was 40 VCs that flew for a half-day event from all across Asia. So the interest in this market is supremely hot. So what better place to be for a firm like myself? We invest in technology. We have scaled up the team over the past 6 months. We have now about 12 people. We're going to be 15 in a couple of months with the new guys coming in. We've moved to a brand new spanking office in Bangsa South, where we have about 4,000 square feet over there. So we are honestly scaling up very quickly.
And in the last 2 years, right, since you've been on the show, what would you say RHL and even yourself have learned about the PE industry? Because, you know, we all start out enthusiastic and eager. But perhaps along the way, there are some hard lessons or disappointments, right?
Definitely is. In any business, obviously, there's ups and downs, right? And my business is finding good companies to invest and obviously making money for my investors. I have a very high IRR target of about 20-25%, which means that I have to make 4-5x of my investors' money over my investment horizon period, which is usually a 7-year period in the VC industry. What that means is that I need to choose the best companies, and I choose companies that are generally early stage, the guys who are Series A, Series B type companies. So you're talking guys who have raised some seed capital, who want to grow, who have a product, and are looking for partners to help grow their business. So in terms of the companies we've looked at, we've probably looked at about a few thousand companies over the past couple of years. We've invested in about 15 companies across different markets. So initially when we started, when we spoke 2 years ago, we did some deals in the US and also Southeast Asia. But now the focus is solely on Southeast Asia, given that there are just a tremendous opportunity set here and an increasing opportunity set in Southeast Asia. So
no mistakes? Anything you regretted you should have done or should not have done?
There are, okay, one of the mistakes I would say, I mean, all SA points that I can learn from is that from a founder's perspective, I invest a lot in the founder, right? Whether in terms of time, effort, and also judging that founder itself. So the founder actually plays an outsized, at least 50% of my investment thesis around a company, given that we are investing in companies that are early stage. Initial part, I've judged a few founders wrongly. So there's guys who can actually sell a very good story but can't execute. And in this market in Southeast Asia, what's the most important actually is execution.
So you've lost money on these investments?
Not even lost money, but you broke even on some of them. So you try to be smart in terms of structuring a deal. You can invest in convertible notes and redeem those notes accordingly when the period of the note is done. So you can find ways to be capital efficient in terms of the investments that you make.
And the last time you here, you said you plan to raise US 100 million. So 2 years later, how have you done? I mean, what's the size of your fund, or is it funds? Because PE funds tend to operate close-ended with certain vintages,
yes,
right? So what's the progress there?
So now we are actually running two funds concurrently. So one fund is obviously the Cayman fund that you mentioned earlier, and that's the $100 million fund. We are busy deploying that at the moment. There's two opportunities in Indonesia and one opportunity in Vietnam that we are closing at the moment. The more recent update, I would say, over the past 4 or 5 months is we launched a fund with SME Corp of Malaysia, and that is a Malaysian-focused fund. We are looking for the best Malaysian startups to invest in, early stage companies across all sectors. So we are looking at companies who can scale up quickly with founders who are strong. And I believe that comes at a critical juncture as our economy is facing a relatively tough time compared to previous years. I feel like good companies will take advantage of this opportunity and excel. So I'm looking for those type of companies. And I'm actually, I would say, one of the maybe 5-6 VC type investors left in Malaysia. And I want to be very aggressive in terms of the deals that I want to do.
And this is the fund that's anchored by SME.
Yes,
Corp.
That's correct.
So essentially for every dollar that you put in, they also match you.
Exactly.
Dollar for
so
dollar.
Every dollar that I raise from corporate investors or high net worth individuals, they will match dollar to dollar. So I believe there's like the first type of matching program that's happened in Malaysia.
And let's spend some time on your investment focus, which is, like you say, you used to invest in US and now you are mainly ASEAN focused, right?
Yeah.
And you look at small and medium companies, because I got this from your website.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, how do you source for that all-important deal? Because I think there's no denying there's plenty of dry powder in this region, right? Just last year, I think there's 70 ASEAN-focused funds in this market.
Yes.
And they're targeting an aggregate $8.5 billion in capital alone, you know. So lots of money chasing probably very few deals. So with your fund size, do companies even want to see you? Or is this where family connections play a big role?
Obviously, you'll be surprised on the number of companies that we meet on a daily basis. So we look at our weekly investment call. We have about 15 to 20 companies that we speak about and we meet at least on a weekly basis or even more. And in terms of opportunity set, the way I see the markets are is you have to be flexible in this market. There are opportunities across earlier stage opportunities, you're talking about like seed Series A, you'll see opportunities in the later stage, so your Series C, Series D type opportunities as well. So I employ a barbell type approach. So invest in a few of the market leaders. So you have guys who have already leading the market, who are already dominating their respective markets. You put a few tickets there. But at the same time, you try to find the gems in the opportunity set as well. So you go much earlier. You're talking about more like seed series A type opportunities. So you want to see the whole opportunity set and not give up one part of the opportunity set just because you're, let's say, a series A focused fund. And what that means for a fund like us is you will see all the opportunities in the market. So when I was in Indonesia 2 weeks ago, just nonstop meetings and found a few deals to invest in. Vietnam, likewise, last week. You have to build, honestly, a strong relationship and network with the local investors. I don't believe in investors can have a strong reach unless they have a local presence. And that's very true in Southeast Asia. You can't just fly in and fly out from Singapore, for instance, and get the best deals over here in Malaysia. Likewise, Indonesia and Vietnam, they have their strong local investors. You have to be able to work with them very well. And it's a mutual relationship. I would say, yes, family plays a part in terms of just building that relationship. But honestly, for every relationship, it's a mutual beneficial one, right? So I give them good deals. They give me good deals. Everyone's happy. Everyone makes money.
But then this is where I struggle with, you see, because everybody says that. Every PE fund who I've spoken to will say that they bring something special to the table. They're looking for the market leaders. And let's say for Series A, where they're willing to take on more risk.
Yep.
But everybody's chasing for the same thing. So, you know, isn't it a very difficult market? I mean, if you, let's say, talk about Series A where there is more risk,
yep.
How do you then manage it? Because you really need to know the sector that you're in,
yes.
Right? To know the business. You're having to compete with the likes of the big boys, PE funds, right? So what advantage do you bring to the table?
So I don't compete with the likes of KKR, CVC, right? They deploy at least like $100 million tickets. So my general ticket size from anything between $500,000 to $5 million. And that's where the speed spot rises. So in terms of opportunity set, I would say we don't really cross with them. We don't cross with the big boys.
What about the Malaysian boys? So the likes of Credo and Navis?
Honestly, they've seen some deals in my space, but they don't play, they're not very active in it. So if they do come in or they do look at a deal, so I haven't seen them deploy any of my deals that I do it. It's very opportunistic and very case-to-case basis. I would say 95% of the deals, I don't see them around at all.
So you're listening to The Breakfast Grill, where I'm speaking to Raja Hamza Abidin Raja Nong, Managing Partner of RHL Ventures. After we come back, we'll be talking about what is the hardest part of private equity, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, welcome back to the Breakfast Grill, where I'm speaking to Raja Hamza Abidin Raja Nong, Managing Partner of RHL Ventures. Earlier, we talked about the competition and whether there's too much money chasing too few deals, and if connections do actually help. But let's talk about some of the recent deals you've done since you last came on the show in 2017.
Yes.
So what kind of names have you added to the fund? Which is the biggest among the names? Because I saw Health Metrics, Signature
yep.
Market, Atap.
Yes.
Rage Coffee.
Yes.
So give us one example or two, which you're, you know, you talk us through that process.
So, I mean, I'll give you a variety of investments so that you get a feel of what we're trying to do, right? So, for instance, Health Metrics, we went in last year. And what they do is a third-party administrator of healthcare claims, purely online. That Alvin came from a background of his family came from a TPA background.
He's the founder, creator of the app.
He's the founder. He actually built this company to disrupt his own family business, similar to what we are trying to do, is disrupting different family business together in one go. Numbers have grown tremendously. They've grown in a period of one year that we invested in them, they've grown about 3.5x in terms of revenue. Their number of clients have grown about 3x. You're talking about average spend has grown about, I think, 2x over the time. And how we help them is we come in, they sell their services to corporates, where corporates can do their healthcare claims and can do their insurance claims through their platform. And we open up corporates to them.
And how much have you invested in this company?
We are re-upping at the moment, so I don't have the exact figure at the moment, so because they're raising a new round. But it's a decent amount, and we've owned a decent amount of the company.
And do you have any sectoral focus? Because Health Metrics is a health app. Signature Market is actually like healthy snack food. And then Rage Coffee is, of course, the chain of,
Kiosk.
Yeah, so it's kind of like a little bit of this and that. So do you have any particular sectoral focus?
Those are early stage companies. The team is to invest in tech focus or tech-enabled companies. For example, Rage Coffee, follows the Luckin Coffee model, unashamedly. Has been scaling up very quickly. They've had 10 outlets in 4 months, and that's just through partnerships, through growth, and they've only raised a small amount of capital.
So you have no restrictions in terms of your mandate?
The restrictions is, I mean,
other than the size, of course, of the investment, but in terms of the sectoral focus, do you say I won't buy, let's say, I know some PE funds say they won't buy property, for example.
So I do have teams that I prefer. So a few teams I feel that are very hot at the moment are teams such as fintech, such as healthcare and logistics.
But isn't that where actually everybody is trying to crowd into? Because that's the sexy sector.
So
now,
exactly, right? So once you crowd within this sectors that people like, you will face tremendous amount of competition. So as a fund, you have to be realistic. You're like, okay, I may like this sector, but you're paying 25 times revenue for this business. Let's try to look around for opportunities.
And I wonder about this Vietnam and Indonesia. Malaysia, yes, home ground. You guys, definitely Malaysians, you know the market. Your families know the markets really well. But what's the advantage, let's say, in Vietnam and Indonesia?
So looking at those two markets, both markets are extremely hot. So Indonesia has been hot for the past couple of years. Vietnam has been increasingly hot. And I would say that the interest in the market has grown over the past 6 months, especially from foreign investors. So as a VC, you would think, yes, I mean, what competitive advantage do we have in the market? In Indonesia, we've just hired a guy to be based there, an Indonesian guy, local guy who knows the on-the-ground presence. And I think that's important in terms of sourcing deals. And building that network of VCs that we've spoken to them for the past maybe 2-3 years and have built that relationship over the past 2-3 years. And there are companies who are Indonesia-based who want to expand across Southeast Asia, and also they want to look at Malaysia to come in. So
Do you expect a higher rate of return for Indonesia and Vietnam?
To be honest, we don't.
You don't? Even though you would think those markets are slightly more risky.
It's a risk-reward story. So I would say in Malaysia right now, there's sort of an arbitrage opportunity. Our startups are generally valued lower from a multiple perspective compared to their overseas peers. If you look at even like the logistics guys over here, they take much longer to raise money compared to the guys in Vietnam and Indonesia for the same amount of money and for a similar amount of traction.
Okay, because you mentioned that you have a methodical approach to kind of determine whether to go into the deal, right?
Yep.
So, okay, we know your rate of return is 20-25%.
Yes.
But what about some of the other things you look at? I mean, you mentioned the importance of the founders. Is there anything else? Does it have to be something special about the company? How do you actually calculate the growth potential? Or, you know, like you say, I can come in and tell you a fantastic story, paint this wonderful picture. How do you actually discern this is the company?
That's a good question, because usually 90% of startups paint that picture that you're talking about.
Of course, if I want your money, I'm going to paint a wonderful story. I'm not going to tell you my business is bad, right?
So usually what happens, the funny part is usually you talk to someone on day one, and 1 year down the line, you cross-check the results. I think most the guys who are a bit too ambitious with their growth story will usually fail their targets, right? So from my perspective, how do we ensure that, other than obviously the founder itself, like how do we look at the business? And I'm not a spray and pray kind of guy. I don't invest in a couple hundred companies and expect like 10 companies to be home runs. I want majority of my companies to do well. And that's more of a fund management approach or institutional approach to investing. What that means is that for every investment deal, that's a very thorough approach that we go through. So there's about 2 rounds of investment committee meetings, and there's 2 rounds of reports that goes through fundamentals of a company, sensitizing their growth plan. So if you think you're going to go 4x and the market's only growing 0.5x, why is that the case? Obviously, then you can sensitize the numbers accordingly. You look at things like competitors and the multiples that they're trading at. Imagine that if you think that a company is trading at, a competitor just raised money at 10x multiples, will they be able to raise money at 10x multiples? Probably not, because you don't want to be over bullish in terms of looking at multiples. You sensitize that accordingly. So everything has to be viewed from a risk-based approach. Everyone thinks of the upside return when investing.
But never the downside,
exactly, right?
Which actually, that's why I'm curious, because if the guy wants your money so badly, and like you say, usually 90% of the time it fails, I would be worried. Also, because one of the conversations I had with another PE fund is that he says conversion is actually the hardest part. Sourcing the deal is easy. But if getting the guy or the founder to take your money sometimes is the hardest part, because if the business is really good and the founder knows it, he's not going to give up his stake so easily, right? He's going to say, what is the value add to me? So how has this conversion process been for you?
So
like for the companies that take your money too fast, maybe, yeah, you're a little bit worried. But for those companies that don't want your money?
Okay, so you can view opportunities from a different spectrums, right? So if a company is extremely desperate for money, as an investor...
Avoid, or
it's the time for you to obviously squeeze them in terms of valuations. I know I sound bad as an investor, but I'm here to make money.
No, it's true. Everybody's here to make money.
Yeah, I mean, I'm here to make money for investors. I will squeeze the hell out of you. That's one. In terms of strong companies that obviously are getting tremendous amounts of interest from shareholders or from external investors, the only way you're going to get in is through a relationship with either the founders or the shareholders itself. And
so is that where the family comes in?
I would say the platform that we've built. So RHL as a whole is a very strong platform now, and it's very well known across Southeast Asia. So having that platform and knowing that, hey, RHL did this deal with me, it helps in terms of getting recommendations, in terms of the deals that we can get access to in Vietnam, in Indonesia. In Malaysia, honestly, I mean, most companies will be open to us anyway. Yeah.
Which leads to the next question. So let's say you succeed, you convert the company. What's the value RHL adds from that day onwards? Because I read in your website about your involvement, you want 10 to 30% equity, right?
Yep.
But then you leave the company's management in the hands of the owners.
Yep.
That's the part I actually struggle with. Because I would think, especially in your space, which is the small, medium-sized companies, you need to be involved in them. That's where operational and financial engineering comes into, right? And that's your specialty.
Yep.
So I know you don't want to stifle entrepreneurial spirit, but don't they need some guidance to grow?
So in general, we do sit on the boards of the various companies that we invest in, assuming that we take a significant equity stake in it. So like, for instance, Health Metrics, we're on the board. Jojo's on the board of Signature Markets. So what this means is that we help on a strategic direction of the company, and we relook into policy, into governance, into processes, and these are the kind of things that are very important for a startup. But I would say there's not a one-size-fits-all approach, because certain companies, maybe the founder may be extremely good at operations but horrible at selling the business, which means that he'll have problems fundraising. And there are a lot of other companies who are the other way around, where the founder is extremely good at selling his story, he's extremely well-versed, he knows the lingo, but he can't manage his business for nuts, right? So,
But would you want to buy a company like that then?
It depends. So if he's good at selling the story, I mean, there is value to someone who's been able to raise money, but you have to make sure that the fundamentals of the business is strong enough. And two, maybe he has a decent CEO that covers his tracks, right? So there's always different ways to look at things. Back to your earlier question on conversion, I mean, in the end, you also, for every investment, whether it's equities, whether it's private markets, you are taking a bet on the company. And you do your best to collect the information, both public and obviously some private from time to time. And then you make your judgment based on that.
So, and on that note, Raja Hamza, thank you for your time today. I wish you good luck in growing RHL Ventures, especially during these rather tough times. I'm Wong Xiaoning for The Morning Run, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.